Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
On this week's show, we welcome ex-Scientologist and author Nancy Menny, who tells us the ins and outs of this eccentric organization, from their bizarre disciplinary tactics to their quest for attaining celebrity members. We then chat with social media maven Alina Fernandez about how to really make social media work for you without being online 24/7. We hear some amazing comedy from Chappie Crisanti and then wrap things up with a remix from Nicki Minaj, Pound the Alarm.
Capture your need for sound.
Nancy Menny was just a college student when she first became interested in Scientology. After wandering into a Scientology office, that was the beginning of 27 years of service at all levels of the organization. Nancy has since left the world of Scientology and now works to help others who have been victimized and to expose the abuse and crimes within the organization. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm happy to be here.
I guess I'm curious to know, when you were a college student, what was it that actually drew you into the world of Scientology?
You have to get the sociocultural context in which I was, which was the 70s. Kind of the tail end of the hippies, although I was a hippie. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, and the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War movement, etc. The Catholic Church, of which I was a member, priests were running off and marrying, and nuns were running off. I mean, it was just, I don't know how to explain it to someone who did not live through it, but it was utter social chaos. There was no institution to hold on to, and there was basically definite feeling, because we were working in all these movements, that the establishment was not to be trusted and not to be helped. So Scientology came into my life when I was really at a loss, because there was nothing I could hold on to. There were no anchors in the world that I could grab onto. Initially, I had no intention of joining, because they called themselves a church. It took them 2 weeks of talking to me and showing me actual things written by Hubbard that showed to me that it was never a real church. In fact, Hubbard's quote was something like, "This change towards religion will not affect our day-to-day business. It is a matter only for attorneys and accountants." Now, that line has since been edited out, but the truth is it still operates today in a lot of the ways it operated back then, and that was as a self-help business. So that's what I was told, and that's what I lived. I mean, I was selling courses and counseling and books for set prices. Just like any other business, we would have sales, we would have packages, and especially through the lower levels that people got into, they felt better that I saw what I saw. There was a lot I did not know, and a lot that is kept from new beginning Scientologists. The lack of religion followed through with me all the way up till the 90s, when one time I tried to go and find, okay, they want to be a church, let's find a church service. And I was in Los Angeles, which had a tremendous number of Scientology organizations, and there were none that I could find. It just wasn't in there. Now, this has been, then when I was working directly with Elon Hubbard in the early 80s, he sent me a communication wherein he said, "I wished I'd never tried to go the church route. I should not have listened to my advisors." So for me personally, it never was a church. And I think my final chapter in my book is, I say, is it a church or not? And I clearly state that it could be either, but it can't continue as both.
Now, by the time you actually got involved, how long had this, I don't even know what you want to call it, religion or way of being, been around, actually, like Scientology? Was it several decades at this point?
Yeah, 2 decades. It began in the 50s, and I got in the 70s.
Okay. And when you actually were a first, a part of the organization, what were your expectations, I guess?
Well, they had a stated goal, which they still have, which for a young, naive college student wanting to make a difference, it starts. It's called the Aims of Scientology, and it's basically to make the world a better place. So I felt I was joining a group of people engaged in activities that would make the world a better place. Initially, I didn't see anything contrary to that in my own little bubble at that one organization I was working at, because I basically introduced new people to it. They bought services that didn't cost a lot of money, and for the most part that I know of, they came back to me happy with whatever I sold them.
Now, when you began your journey, I guess, with Scientology, did it start to infringe, I guess is the word I'll use, on your life sort of immediately, like, or was it a gradual build-up to it becoming such, you know, I guess, it sounds like it was obviously a very important part of your life for many, many years.
It was a big part of my life for many, many years. The first thing that I look at where the group took over me and my own personal inclinations was that they would not let me have time off to go and visit my family. Now, my family lived 20 minutes away, so this was just insane to them, and it was insane to me. And I bowed to the intense, not just peer pressure, but also pressure from above. They did do punishments, despite what they recently said about the punishment of cleaning toilets with a toothbrush. That was a common practice way back then. I've never seen it personally until this woman came forward, done on a public person, especially a person that's an up-and-coming celebrity. So that's it's filtered on out into the general Scientologist as opposed to being an in-house punishment. The not ability to go see my family, you see, then upset them. Because they were upset, the organization told me that they were suppressive people. Suppressive people are supposedly 2.5% of the society, and they're just secretly evil, and therefore they didn't want me to have contact with my family. Well, the only reason why my family was attacking Scientology is because they wouldn't let me go see them. Do you see the loop there?
Mm-hmm.
And so the more upset they would get, the more they would tell me how nasty they are and I shouldn't have them in my life. So that was bad. That was bad. That, I would think, was the first thing that overrode my personal desires.
And how quickly, I guess, did you, you know, rise up through the ranks? Because if I understand things correctly, you obviously became, you know, a part of the inner sanctum, if you will.
Yeah. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but I walked into the inner sanctum in the 70s. The Boston organization, the Boston Org, as they still call it today, they don't in-house say, oh, the Boston Church. No, they say the Boston Org, which is short for organization. That's the common language. The Boston Org had been sent what they called a command team. There were about 12 men who were in the high, high, high ranks, and they were personally sent by L. Ron Hubbard to Boston, because as a group they had done something bad when they were running the United States and Canada. And so as punishment, Hubbard took them all together and sent them as a team to this little place that was the Boston Org. So I entered with these giants, quote-unquote, of the organization. They worked directly with Hubbard. They came directly from Hubbard. Hubbard watched what they did while they were in Boston. They were all high level in terms of both training and the counseling. Scientology has these two sides where you go up the ladder, and one side is spiritual counseling. Applied philosophy is what they used to call it, or still do. And they were very high up on both levels, extremely. So I kind of walked in to the top ranks. And those friendships and connections remained with me for years. So it wasn't much of a jump for me to end up working directly with Hubbard.
And how long did you actually work with him?
My initial boss in working with him was Diana Hubbard, his daughter. And so I was her deputy. I was, you know, so it was like not necessarily direct, but indirect. He knew me. We had correspondence, but it was when my boss, when Diana went off to have her baby, and I was given the position, and that was my first direct Hubbard to me communications, and there were a lot of them.
And so what did your role become then? Like, it sounds like, you know, because I've watched a bit of footage of interview footage with you before, and it sounds like you ended up getting into, it sounds like there's a lot of different, I guess, sections of Scientology, and it sounded like you ended up getting into the promotional part of it slash marketing, I guess.
Yes, but it was the marketing for new individuals and celebrities. That Hubbard had it had several aides. I was the aide for what was called at that time Division 6. Now, Division 6 was responsible for the expansion of Scientology around the world. This is another place where my, you know, it's not a real church was so evident to me because I was working on opening up Scientology into Japan. Now, Japan, as a country, you can't open up a religion there. So we didn't. We opened up a self-help group. But it was the exact same, we sold the exact same things. The same in Mexico. All that organization is not, we weren't able to open as a religion. The same in Israel. Just because that's the way those countries are. And so to me, it was like, okay, fine. You know, you want brown eggs? Well, we have brown eggs. You want white ones? Well, we have white ones. It could morph into anything because it wasn't really a church. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Definitely. On the show with us right now is ex-Scientologist Nancy Menny, author of My Billion-Year Contract. You can check it out, mybillionyearcontract.com. When you were in, I guess, the promotion of the Scientology around the world, at this point, did you obviously have knowledge of things that you might not have been happy with about maybe some of the treatment that was going on? And I don't know if I can use this word, but is it cult-like?
Oh, it most definitely is a cult. Now, many things are a cult. The difference is it a destructive cult? Like Amway could be called a cult.
Right.
You know, but that doesn't mean it's a destructive cult. There are actual criteria of what makes a cult destructive. And that's basically whenever you join a group as an individual, you give up some of your individuality to be a member of the group. And there's normally some exchange, like you go have a job. You can't freely show up whenever you want when you have a job. The group impacts you in terms of your schedule, but there's an exchange. You get paid for it. And in Scientology, you give up way too much, or in any destructive cult, you lose completely your individuality. They control, like with my parents. No, you can't go. You can't have time off to go see your parents. Now, I was working 7 days a week. When am I supposed to, you know, see anybody? You are monitored in terms of what outside information you can read or look at. You don't have time to watch TV. And then later in my years, TV was forbidden. You don't have time to go to the movies. You don't, you know, the group is just overwhelming you as an individual.
Wow, that's really interesting to know, because I think that's very important that people understand that, because, yeah, obviously it just becomes more and more isolating, I would guess.
Yes, exactly. And I see most of my job when I was in the C organization, which is the elite billion-year contract group, and then later when I worked out as a public person, I was always involved with celebrities, with non-Scientologists, with people that just had real lives. And it would amaze me of the huge number of Scientologists that didn't have any non-Scientology friends, that lived in like Scientology apartment complexes or Scientology rooming houses. All their friends were Scientologists. They went to a Scientology job. In the exclusion of anything outside of that group is intense.
And what sort of repercussions happens if you disobey them, like, you know, watching TV or whatever it is? Like, is it like different ranks or different levels of you getting in trouble?
Yes, different levels of being punished. The topmost level of being punished is they will declare you a suppressive person. Now, once you are declared a suppressive person, you are no longer allowed. No Scientologist is allowed to talk with you, or they get into trouble, or give you money, or be with you or anything. I once went through a situation that was very, very bad for me and did end up having a bad outcome, but I felt I had to be there for it because the threat was I could lose all my friends, my job, my husband, my children, etc. And that's a real, real threat. The people that have been coming out lately, once it is publicly known that they no longer consider themselves Church of Scientology as under the current leader of David Miscavige, anyone, they, you know, you just watch their Facebook friends, and they just, that's it. I mean, they don't even talk to you. They just cut you off.
Wow.
You know, they just unfriend you. So it's like there you have 1,000 friends, and poof, you have 100.
Now, a question.
Overnight.
Now, a question for you, I guess, with regards to your marital status and stuff. Did you marry, like, a fellow Scientologist?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it becomes very inclusive then. It's just like a little community on its own.
It's very inclusive. It's very inclusive. But he was like me. He was the captain of the Celebrity Center.
Okay.
And for the final 2 years that I was active in the Billionaire Contract Group, I was the president of Celebrity Center. So it was really, really a lot more relaxed, a lot more kid gloves when you're trying to get a celebrity to join the group.
Can you talk a little bit about that, Nancy? Because, again, I think so many of us, our experience of Scientology is the Scientologist that we see on television or know that, you know, this celebrity is involved in it, like a John Travolta, obviously a Tom Cruise, I believe Kirstie Alley, people like that.
Yeah, they're brought in with kid gloves. They're not what's called in Scientology hard sell, which actually I think is a business sales term. They don't get the hard sell, which is buy now or forget it, you know, kind of thing. No, they're kid gloved, they're hand walked. What they don't know is in the way that Scientology markets itself, as everybody knows, anytime you have a business, it's word of mouth. So once any person becomes, they cross that bridge and say, you know what, I think I'm a Scientologist, or I want to join this group, or I'm whatever, then they start having contact with the salesmen, which are called registrars, and they sit down and talk about any and all of their friends who might like and benefit from Scientology like that person did himself. So you make up a list, and then you go through it. Now, the targeted person has no concept that his best friend is telling you, the salesperson, everything about your intimate life, your intimate problems, your whatever's going on with you. With a lot of celebrities, when I went to go do the interaction, the introduction, the friend who was a Scientologist, usually there'd be some kind of party or some kind of get-together, and I would go as that person's plus one. So then I'm in a room full of celebrities, and specifically the target.
Wow, that's fascinating. It's even fascinating that we'd use the word target.
No, really.
Yeah.
There is L. Hiving Hubbard even called them the celebrity targets.
Because is the reason that everyone is so, or I guess the objective to get celebrities, because it brings more high-profileness mm-hmm. to Scientology?
Now, the
correct?
Definition of celebrity also includes businessmen, and they have targeted huge amounts of wealthy businessmen. Rupert Murdoch.
Mm-hmm.
His son was really involved, which is why he made that odd little tweet about there's more evil to come out. He's very familiar with Scientology. And Rupert Murdoch's son got the international businessman from Australia, Packard, involved. Now, these aren't names that you commonly know. In the business world, you know them.
Right.
Big time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't be considered celebrities. They aren't entertainment fluff, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I learned with working with celebrities is that most people do not know that while a person might be famous, that doesn't mean they have a lot of money. Those are two different things. The people that have the real money in the entertainment business, you don't even know their names.
It's like the producers and behind-the-scenes agents, all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. And they're the ones that are getting all the big bucks, but they don't get the blessing slash curse of celebrity.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a little bit, you know, because I think everyone's main experience with Scientology from, you know, the general public's perspective is Tom Cruise. And obviously he has been very vocal for years, you know, about Scientology to a point. I mean, it's, you don't often see certain things coming out of his mouth, but I know obviously several years back when he got into that very famous sort of spat on air with Matt Lauer from NBC, you know, and then
jumping on the couch.
Yeah, and jumping on the couch, all that sort of stuff. What's your take on him, Tom Cruise? Because, you know, I think a lot of people think that he is very high up the ladder and is not just a parishioner, if you will.
Yes, he is best friends with David Miscavige, the current leader. He has received, like, Scientology basically doesn't, the staff works 7 days a week and sometimes 24 hours a day. So it's like slave labor because they aren't paid and they have no control. They can't go to bed when they want to. I had a friend I took into my home who I have an incredible bed, and most people come down for breakfast and they were like, wow, I love that bed. Well, she came down and she was like, no, I slept on the floor. And I said, what do you mean you slept on the floor? And she said, well, I'm not used to beds because for years I would be sleeping on the floor under my desk because they wouldn't let me go home to sleep.
Wow, that's insane.
I mean, I already knew of the abuses, but that one was like jaw-dropping.
Right.
And it took her years to get back to sleeping in a bed, seriously.
So does Tom, for example, know that this is going on? Or is he kept from this so that he can honestly say, no, this doesn't happen?
I don't, you know, from his level, yes, he is surrounded by people that monitor his every move. When you saw the Matt Lauer, the jumping on the couch and that big, huge outburst towards Scientology, he had for years, as an entertainer, had a publicist named Pat Kingsley, and she's brilliant. And she managed all of his interviews, his publicity, all that kind of stuff. And her take on it was, okay, you're a Scientologist. You like that. That's not what we're publicizing. We're publicizing Tom Cruise, the actor. And that's what we want you talking about. And we want you talking about these films and your roles and all that kind of stuff. So she really muzzled his communications on Scientology. Well, of course, Scientology doesn't like this. And I just know from other work with other celebrities that then that publicist or manager, whoever it is, who doesn't like Scientology, doesn't want that celebrity to speak openly about it, then they become targets to get rid of them. You see, then they start working on Tom to dump Kingsley.
Wow.
So Kingsley was dumped, and Tom's sister, who's very, very involved in Scientology, she's actually signed a billionaire contract herself, was put in charge of his publicity. And she'd never really been a publicist, let alone a publicist for a major celebrity. And because she was a Scientologist, it was okay. Let her rip to disastrous results. So that's where Scientology manipulation comes in.
And so, for example, with Tom, how much do you think his daily life is obviously affected by Scientology? Like, because you do see him out, let's say, you know, if a tabloid magazine, you know, has snapped pictures of him, you know, with his kids at soccer games and stuff like that. So is that soccer game, like, let's just say, is that all, like a soccer game full of Scientologists, or is it actually like regular people?
No, it would be regular people, but there's no doubt that Tom always has in the back of his mind. He became very close with that gazillionaire down in Australia, Packard, you know, so he and his connection with Will Smith, and now Will Smith and his wife have a Scientology school. So, you know, these things are, he is a, every public Scientologist that's out in the world has a duty to talk to and bring in new people.
Wow, that's so fascinating. And with, you know, because I know earlier you had mentioned before we started the interview that you have spoken and obviously know John Travolta. How has he managed to sort of slip under the radar? Because, I mean, we know that he is a Scientologist. I mean, that's been mentioned several times, but it's obviously not to the degree that we always know about Tom Cruise.
John Travolta does, from what I understand, and this is my opinion, through his actions, he doesn't like the way that David Miscavige has really turned Scientology into. Now, you've also got the gay issue.
Oh, I didn't even know there was one. You tell us about it.
There have been, before this recent one that I think is really going to get it out of the closet.
Yeah.
There were other ones years ago. Right before he married Katie, there was a gentleman that came forward who expressed that he had been John's lover for years. And he was going to write an expose. And I do know that Scientology sent their own private investigators. Whether they charged John Travolta privately for that, I do not know. But they were private investigators who were seasoned in dealing with Scientology issues. Somehow, this guy got shut up. And there are many ways in which they get people to shut up. I did also spend time in espionage, so I'm very familiar with the manipulation that goes on from that arena. The guy was gotten to shut up, and within 2 months, oh my God, John is engaged to Kelly now.
Kelly Preston.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A fellow Scientologist. All you have to do is go back through Google, take a look at the press at that time, and you'll see both stories and the coincidence of that. Now, as far as celebrities, I have to say this. People always talk about, oh, Scientology, the celebrity religion, the celebrity group, whatever. Well, who have they gotten in? I mean, you're talking, you mentioned the same old for years. The only new celebrity that I am aware of that they have made a Scientologist who's really going ahead with it is Louis Farrakhan.
Wow.
The entire movement of Nation of Islam have become Scientologists. You weren't aware of that?
Not even a little bit. And I try I try to keep up to date with a lot of things, but I had no clue.
Yeah. And they are, and he had a speech that he gave when the moment was there. And he said, we're going in a new direction. You can either come with us or not. And if you don't, we thank you for your service. And that was when it all began. It's unbelievable. And a recent scandal that came was a marriage between Scientology and Nation of Islam. They got a charter school in Tampa, Florida. Money is missing. Teachers weren't paid. It was a huge mess. It was a charter school, so it was funded with government money, and it was run by people from Louis Farrakhan and people from the Scientology front group for education called Applied Scholastics. They get in their government funding, and off the top, tens of thousands of dollars, whoops, they go to the woman in Los Angeles who runs Applied Scholastics. So the governor shut it down, and it's, you know, all their financial mismanagement is being thoroughly investigated. But those kids were the lowest testing kids in the entire Tampa school system. That's how bad it was.
That's ex-Scientologist and author Nancy Menny, who wrote the book My Billion-Year Contract. She's going to be back on the show next week for part two of our chat with more details on how Scientology works, including the fact that they actually have an espionage unit and that actress Katie Holmes was definitely followed during her split from Tom Cruise. For more information on Nancy, check out our website, mybillionyearcontract.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Alina Fernandez is a best-selling author, international keynote speaker, and award-winning guerrilla positioning strategist. While being a mother of two, she teaches mom entrepreneurs how social media can work for them. Welcome, Alina, to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. How are you doing today? Thank you for having me.
No problem. Fantastic. Happy to have you on the show. And, you know, we hear a lot about how social media can have a huge impact on any business, whether it's a big business or a small business. But it can also be quite overwhelming, I think, to be dealing, you know, with Facebook and Twitter and blogs and all that sort of stuff. So I guess, what are some of the myths that you often hear about social media?
Oh, thank you so much for asking that question. You know, social media is such a powerful tool, and it is such a shame to hear people say that they don't want to do it because they don't have time, or they don't think that it's going to work for them, or the biggest one is that it's a waste of their time. And some of the things that I hear constantly are based on the fact that you don't have a strategy or a plan, or what I like to call a blueprint, to purposely do social media and make it work for you.
One of the things that you often talk about is not being afraid of positioning yourself as an expert. Why should anyone, you know, position themselves as an expert?
Thank you so much for that. Social media is actually one of the ways that you can do that. You can position yourself as an expert. And what I like to call selfish humility, and I'll explain in a second what that is. I think that is the main thing that holds people back from positioning themselves. When you position yourself as an expert, you actually have the ability to have your voice be heard and to get people excited about your brand, about whatever it is that you have to offer. You don't showcase your expertise. You'll attract and engage a bigger audience. You'll help more people, and you will have fun doing what you love and what you're passionate about, but other people will benefit from that. And don't forget, Kelly, that also through your effort and your results, you'll also grow your partnerships, you'll get media attention, and you can charge expert fees. We can't forget about that part. But going back to the selfish humility, it's that thing that tells us, oh, well, you're not a person that needs to be teaching this, or you're too humble, or you don't want to let people know about your gifts and your talents and your brilliant ideas. So you're doing a disservice to the world by hiding that from us.
I see. Now, and I guess you're not, you want to make sure, though, that if you are positioning yourself as an expert, you really do know what you're talking about, obviously.
Yes, there are expectations, but the main thing to know is that being an expert is not about you and what you know. It's about your audience and what you can teach them. So do you remember being in first grade and thinking, wow, the third graders have it all together? You remember that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, you don't have to know everything. You have to know enough to help people and guide them in their way. Your product, your service, your idea, your brand, your personal brand has to be of use, helpful. You have to have knowledge and know-how and experience, teaching ability, communication, and clarity. Those are things that an expert has. They don't have everything together, because one of the main qualities of a leader and an expert is that they learn, that they're open to be curious and to expand their knowledge and their creativity. So if you are a person of service that can help other people, then you are an expert. And seriously, if you think about it, some people get on a panel for being an expert mom just because they're a mom. They know what it is to be one. Or you're a man and you're in a panel of men. So you really need to think about what you can help others with, and that is your expertise.
Now, how important is it to have a system when it comes to social media? Because I can tell you from personal experience, I'm a radio announcer as my day job, and I have so many social media networks that I'm on, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, you know, Instagram, all that sort of stuff, and it can feel overwhelming. So, you know, again, it is important, obviously, to have a system or a plan of action, I guess.
Yes, and one that I can give you is having an intentional calendar. And what that means is that you're going to set your intention. What is it that I want to get out of social media? And based on that, you're going to then strategically find what networks make sense for you, how you can integrate them, and then how you can be present and how much you want to allow. And I know what you're talking about, because I'm a mom of two and I homeschool my children, and I write books and I speak in front of groups, and I'm very, very active on social media, but it doesn't take a lot of my time because I have a system. And system stands for save yourself time, energy, and money. If you are systematically doing things and not reinventing the wheel, that takes away all the guesswork and all of the chasing your tail part that is going to drain you and not make you excited about doing something. But I guarantee you, one thing that you can do right now is set an intentional calendar of what you're going to post, where you're going to post it, and how long it'll take you. And a consistency in that plan will help you because I'm a firm believer in the compound effect. You don't have to be on social media every day, all day. You just have to do a little bit each day or whenever it's convenient and your schedule allows. And if that's consistent and if you're really giving helpful messages out there, then your dent is going to be bigger every day.
Can you tell us about, you know, a potential plan of action for setting your, frequency of doing the social media? Because like you said, you don't have to be on it every day all the time so that your life is, you know, buried in your smartphone. But, you know, like do you need to sort of plan for the week or do you try to plan for the day? Like, I'm going to do 3 updates.
No, it is for the week and hopefully for the month. And if you're going to do a weekly one, a good idea to start with, and of course, you know, this is a generic idea because I work with people one-on-one to see what will make sense for them, for the size of their business, for their goals, because some people want to grow brand awareness and others want to just push a sale. So, you know, it really depends what you are pushing and what you're wanting to get. But in order to get credibility, you know, and visibility and profitability, I think that a good plan is to decide for a whole week what are you going to do each day, how long you're going to do it, put it in your calendar, just as you would prospecting. And, you know, we're all business people. We know that we have a time to network and a time to follow up and a time to prospect. So let's put that on the calendar as social media marketing and let's spread it out throughout the week. You don't have to be on Facebook every day if you can't. You know, do Facebook on Monday and say, you know, I'm going to post a picture this day and this day I'm going to post a message and a quote and I'm going to find an article that is helpful. So kind of spread things out. You don't have to do everything every day. And, you know, be kind to yourself and to your schedule because then you're going to fall in love with social media. Because I can tell you because that happened to me. I am in love with it and I am excited to share with others and to see the difference that I make in the world. And it is beautiful when you can do it, not from a sacrificial point of view, but from a generous point of view. You're giving up what you have and it's energizing you versus draining you.
On the show is Alina Fernandez, author of Social Media Success Made Possible. Check it out for sure on our website, alinafernandez.com. Can you tell me a little bit about guerrilla positioning? You know, what is it and why is it important?
Absolutely. And that's a beautiful concept because I learned it from J. Conrad Levinson, who is the father of guerrilla marketing. And what he does is, you know, he teaches how you can, without a huge investment of money, but a reasonable investment of time and creativity and imagination, you can market yourself and you can get out there and get your message heard. And then positioning, what that is gaining a place in your prospect's mind, in your customer's mind, that allows them to think of you when they need the product, the service, or the idea, or the support that you bring. So I combine the two concepts, and I say, you know, let's position ourselves as experts, as go-to people, as leaders in our marketplace, and let's do it the guerrilla way, you know, without a lot of money, without a lot of time, without a lot of resources. And, you know, that is the only way that I could have done it, because I became a single mom, and I had a 40-plus hour job, and I didn't have money or time or a support group. So you have to be creative in this day and age to market yourself if you don't have a lot of resources. But you also have to know that in the over-communicated society, you have to do something outrageous and something worth listening in order to be heard. So that's what guerrilla positioning is. And the importance, Kelly, is that basically if you don't do it, you're just going to be one of the crowd. And nobody's going to listen or buy from you, or you're not going to change anybody's lives with your message and your product because you're too shy to put it out there.
So what is the secret then to success in guerrilla positioning? Is it to be outside the box?
Yes, but you know, it really, even if you're not, because sometimes your personality doesn't allow you to be too outrageous and crazy, and that's okay. I think that the main thing is focus. And I love acronyms because I'm a homeschooler.
Okay, yep.
So, you know, yeah, focus is actually follow one course until successful.
Okay.
Don't give up. You know, if social media didn't work this week, keep on doing it. Keep on doing it consistently and creatively and find better ways and test, but keep on. Don't stop.
Now, how easy or difficult is it to get, you know, more credibility and visibility through social media?
It's very easy. It's very easy. You just have to have an intention. And I have a formula called LIKED, and that's another acronym. Listen first. You know, then just start talking to people without knowing exactly what they need to hear. Then interact with them and build those relationships. So you're going to be, you know, commenting to what they're saying. Then keep it simple. Talk like you would to a five-year-old, because you don't know. Again, you're an expert, even if you don't know it. So sometimes the terms we use when we're sharing our expertise go over people's heads. And then the E is for educate, empower, entertain. And the D is for do it authentically, consistently, and strategically. So basically all of that, what it means is listen and be helpful. Think before you post, and post something that will connect them more to you. Don't tell them what you had for breakfast unless that has an intention and it's part of a strategy.
I like that. I think that's great. I think people need to know that, because it is so easy to get wrapped up in putting out the wrong information.
Yes. And, you know, I have another formula called the BLT, and it's believe, like, and trust. And you can kind of do a test over that. You know, is this going to make me more believable, more likable, and more trustworthy to my audience? Then, okay, I'll post it.
How can you expose your business, I guess, to millions of people online if your network is limited to start off with? Like, let's say, you know, you've started up, I don't know, like a cupcake making business or cakes or something. And let's say you only have 100 Facebook friends. How are you going to get that out to, you know, thousands of people or millions of people?
That is a great question. Some of the things that I practice are, you know, what I call the 7 P's. And 2 of those come to mind when you say that. And one is partnerships. When you align yourself with people that have a bigger audience, that have more ideas, that you have mentors that help you get the message out there, that is one way to do it. And the other way is through press, you know, doing online releases, growing your list, giving something out for free. So basically, looking for ideas on how to break that gap. Because, you know, right now I have almost 100,000 followers on Twitter, but I started with 1 follower.
Yeah, right.
Just like everybody else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's that, you know, following the media, following the people that are influential in the audience or to the audience that you want to reach, and being helpful, helping others and connecting with others and being genuine. I think that's the key to growing your business and growing your customer base as well.
Now, just for example, if we use your Twitter example, the fact that you now have, you said you have over 100,000. Is that, you know, to grow that, did you also, was it important, you know, to use hashtags? Like, is it important how you wrote your information so that you're being found on Twitter search engines?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that comes with using it. I think that, you know, you don't have to be great to be started, but you have to get started to be great.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you don't know the lingo and the tweets and how to use the acronyms and the hashtags, I think that comes with the practice, and you will get more familiar, and that absolutely helps. But if you just get out there and get a Twitter account and start tweeting and start, like I said, the first L is for listening. You're going to learn how it's done, and you're going to see the people that are getting the most followers and that are getting the most retweets. You're going to see how they're doing it, and you're going to follow their example, because you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just have to learn from the people that know what they're doing. And so, yes, it does help to know the strategies, and it does help to get known and visible, but it also helps is to go and do it. Get your feet wet and make some mistakes. That's how we started talking and walking and doing everything we do.
Now, in your opinion, Alina, which social media tool is the most effective? Is it Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, like, or are they all combined to get you where you need to go?
Yes, you are right, Kelly. It is all combined. Marketing in itself is a mix. You know, it all started with the four P's of marketing, and that's what I learned in college. And, you know, you need a presence in everything. A lot of social media experts, say that the yellow book, the yellow pages, are obsolete. I don't think that anything is obsolete. I think that there's an audience for every medium. And although I advocate for social media, I go to live networking events as well. I do paper magazines and all kinds of press. So, you know, really having a balance and knowing where your audience is, I think that's the most helpful for you. It's going back to that blueprint and that strategy and that system on where your audience is and when they're going to be. Wayne Gretzky, who is called the great hockey player, not just a good one, he's the great because he says that he's able to see the puck, not where it is, but where it's going to be. So go to and show up in the places where your audience is and where they're going to be. And if that's Facebook for you, then do Facebook the most. But also don't forget about LinkedIn. If you're B2B, if you're doing business with other businesses, that's where you need to hang out. So realize that whatever your target market is, they have a group on Facebook, they have a group on LinkedIn, they have a list on Twitter, you know, they're doing Pinterest. Where are they hanging out? Think about your audience. Don't think about what you like and what you're most comfortable with, because you are not your target market.
That is such a key piece of information, because I think a lot of people get lost in that, where they're like, well, this is what I want. And it's like, no, if you're putting out this information or this is what your product is, you need to think about the people that are supposed to be purchasing it from you.
Absolutely. It's about them. It's what is it, that you have to offer to me? How do you solve my problem? What is the solution that you have to offer? How are you going to help me reach my goals or delete these frustrations that I'm having? They're not thinking about your comfort.
Now, and something I also wanted to ask you, Alina, just in regards to the word, I guess, guerrilla, because obviously that made me think of guerrilla marketing and all that sort of stuff. And an example that I like to use, I guess, would be Justin Bieber, because I know when he started out singing, you know, they had him singing at every little country fair and, barbecue cook-off and everything until he started to build up, you know, his fan base. And then it took off from there. So for a small company, do you say that they should go into their backyard sort of thing, like, you know, at local community events, and then start building up following there, and then hopefully word of mouth? Is that something that you would suggest?
Absolutely. And I was just talking to someone yesterday and saying, you know, I didn't start out speaking on a big stage and big events. I started at my Chamber of Commerce. That's a good resource if you're a small business. I started at, you know, networking events and meetups. Check out meetups.com and see, you know, what little groups of people you can be a contribution for, and start speaking there, start networking there, and see if there's a small paper. You know, even in I started teaching a class, and now that I think about it, I started teaching a class about web design in my local high school.
Okay.
And so things like that are creative that people wouldn't be thinking about, those things skyrocketed my business. When I won Best Marketer in the state of Florida, I attribute that to the fact that I was teaching these classes and that the media was really, really paying attention to doing good in the community, and to contributing to people that didn't have a lot of resources on how to learn web design and blogging and social media marketing and email marketing and even book publishing. And I was doing that, and people pay attention. And so that went statewide. And I can't say that I've won those awards, but it didn't start that way. So you can see how consistently doing something and having a presence and being a key component to contributing to the community can make a huge impact.
Fantastic. Well, Alina, I really think your information is fascinating. And how can people get a copy of your book so they can pick up more of your tips?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. They can go to my website, elainafernandez.com. That's E-L-A-Y-N-A, fernandez.com. And they can also connect with me on Facebook or Twitter. I would love to answer the questions and give them more tips. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you for the opportunity. God bless you.
That's Elaina Fernandez, again, creator and facilitator of social media empowerment workshops. You can find out about her book, Social Media Success Made Possible. Check out her website, elainafernandez.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
It's nice to be back here at the Apollo. I did the show last series, and after it was on TV, people kept twittering me. If you are on Twitter, do twat me. Because I talked last time a lot about being Iranian, and people tweeted me going, are you really Iranian? I'm like, no, I just say that to be more popular. That's all right. My career's going okay. Everything's going fine. It's at a point now for me where people come up to me in the street and go, excuse me, are you Omid Jalili? I never really wanted to be a stand-up. I actually wanted to be a doctor. My parents pushed me into stand-up comedy. But my big dream in life was to be an actress, but with the way I look, the only job I'd ever get would be someone's cousin off EastEnders. Right, Ian? Sitcoms. That's what I dreamed of doing when I was a kid. I wanted to be an actress on a sitcom. And in 2003, that dream almost came true when I got a part in a sitcom pilot. And I was so excited, and it went to series. And I was playing an Iraqi nanny. And it went to series. I was like, this is brilliant. This is my big break. And then we attacked Iraq. The producers decided it was no longer appropriate to have an Iraqi nanny in a British sitcom, and they got rid of me. Now, I know that there were probably better reasons to have been against the war. But as I marched, ladies and gentlemen, I knew there'd been some personal cost to me.
Bring on the
remix.
Now, what I gotta do to show these girls that I own them? Some call me Nicki Allen, some call me Robin. Visa, please, I'm in a visa. Just happy to not be my own freaker. Sexy, sexy, that's all I do. If you need a bad chick, let me call up yo. I'm someone and I'm little, many girls to tell. I see some good girls, I'ma turn them out. I can bottle, sip, bottle, guzzle. I'm a bad chick, no muzzle. Bottle, sip, bottle, guzzle. I'm a bad chick, no muzzle.
Nicki Minaj with Pound the Alarm, the Liam Keegan radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big thank you, as always, to my guests, this week Nancy Menny, as well as Alina Fernandez. I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Karen E. Quinones-Miller. When someone tells you no, it doesn't mean that you can't do it. It simply means that you can't do it with them. Don't forget that next week on the show, part two of our chat with Nancy Menny, ex-Scientologist and author of My Billion-Year Contract. Make sure to tune in for that. And don't forget to keep up to date with our website for new blog posts and pictures of things that are happening around the world, kellyalexandershow.com. And also check out our Twitter feed, KAlexandershow. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.